Our final presentation is just for fun. It's the presidential address to the society by A.H. Buddy Giesecke of Dallas, whose professional life has brought him into contact with some very well-known individuals, and occasionally with unique anesthetic requirements. But Dr. Giesecke tells the story better.
I was at Parkland Hospital on noon, November the 22nd, 1963, when the president arrived, and I participated to a limited extent in his resuscitation. I subsequently anesthetized Governor Connally for his exploratory thoracotomy, and all these patients were exciting. The one that I want to tell you about has no national reputation, although she is well known around Dallas. The patient is 11 years old, 4.5 feet tall, weighs 225 pounds, and has an arm spread of 81 inches. She's one of the three gorillas who lived at that time in the Dallas Zoo. On the 21st of June, 1965, Dr. Charles Sloan and I were contacted by Dr. Jack Brundrett, the veterinarian at the Dallas Zoo, complaining that for the past 8 days, Jenny had been vomiting, had had no oral intake, and that for 7 days she had had no stools in her cage, and for the past 4 days there had been no urine in her cage. He made the diagnosis, the tentative diagnosis, of an intestinal obstruction with extracellular fluid deficit and recommended that she have various diagnostic procedures followed, if necessary, by an exploratory laparotomy. Because of the animal's rather hostile personality, he felt that general anesthesia would be necessary for both the diagnostic procedures and for the operation. Accordingly, Dr. Charles Sloan and I gathered up a large collection of airway equipment and an old Heidbrink anesthesia machine, which we loaded into the back of a Falcon station wagon and set off with fear and trembling for the Dallas Zoo. When we arrived, the animal was obviously lethargic, dozing in the corner, until someone approached the cage, at which time she rose and greeted us with several loud growls. She was in a holding cage, which was to the rear of the usual public display cages. The holding cage had one movable wall by which animals can be compressed against the opposite wall and held for minor treatments and medications. The cage was compressed and 200 milligrams of Tranvet, which is propiopromazine, the same thing as Largon in human parlance, was given intramuscularly with a long needle. Now, veterinarians... Veterinarians test for adequate tranquilization of primates by what they call the lip test. The lip is flipped with the finger, and if it's retracted by the animal is considered not to be sufficiently tranquilized to be handled. However, if the lip is not retracted and is insensitive, then it's considered that the animal is safe to handle. The propiopromazine was given at 3:30 in the afternoon, and the lip test became negative here at 4 o'clock. Dr. Charles Sloan then, armed with an IV needle and a bottle of fluids, entered the cage along with three or four zoo attendants. I was supporting the bottle. A tourniquet was placed on the gorilla's arm, and at the first needle puncture, she raised her arm up over her head and went, "Arr!" In the scramble to get out of the cage, we dropped the IV fluids. One of the attendants developed a crick in his neck when he jerked to the side and headed for the door. It was felt wiser to pull the arm out of the cage, secure it with ropes which were held by attendants, and the IV was finally successfully started 40 minutes later in the left arm. I might point out that although gorillas are very clean animals and have almost no animal odor to them, their skin is very thick and their veins are deeply placed. Starting an IV in this gorilla was somewhat like starting an IV in the foot with the shoe still on. Once the IV was started, we gave 3 liters of normal saline at a fairly rapid rate before we gave any additional depressant drugs. At that time, we gave pentothal in small incremental doses of 40 to 60 milligrams until a total of 600 milligrams had been given. It was felt that it was safe to enter the cage and move the gorilla onto the improvised operating room table. A ratchet-operated veterinary mouth opener was placed in the mouth, and the mouth open to its maximum extent. It is of interest that the mouth opening was 11 inches from the upper incisors to the lower incisors. The mouth itself was quite deep, and at the bottom of this huge cavern, you could see the epiglottis, which was a club-like structure rather than a leaf-like structure. The epiglottis was anesthetized with a little topical ponacaine and was easily elevated with the tip of a number 4 Goodell blade, and the trachea was intubated without difficulty with a size 42 French endotracheal tube at about 5 o'clock. This is 1.5 hours now after the beginning of anesthesia. And really, this was one of the things that gave us the greatest fear in going out and performing the anesthesia for this animal, was whether or not we were going to be able to get her intubated. And sure enough, it turned out to be a very simple job. The endotracheal tube was connected to this old Heidbrink anesthesia machine, and nitrous oxide and oxygen was given along with methoxyfluorine, which was vaporized from a number 8 jar. The blood pressure was taken with an oversized human blood pressure cuff and found to be 120/40. Pulse rate was 90 and the respiratory rate was 20. A nasogastric tube was passed through the mouth, and barium was instilled into the stomach. Several films were made by the radiologist in various positions for interpretation. The films were carried by high-speed police pursuit car to the hospital, where they were developed and brought back with sirens blowing, lights burning all the way. And there was plenty of help in moving the patient from one position to the other. This, of course, is a luxury that we don't enjoy in the usual hospital. It was demonstrated that the barium did not pass the pyloric sphincter, and atropine, 1 milligram of atropine, was given in an effort to relax the pyloric valve and allow the barium to pass into the intestine. This did not work, so it was decided to do a laparotomy. Along about 8:30 in the evening, we noticed a slowly enlarging swelling of the neck. The swelling became very large, it was crepitant, and it was felt to represent subcutaneous emphysema by Dr. Sloan and myself. Fearful that we had ruptured the trachea, we finally decided to call it to the attention of the veterinarian. He giggled and told us that this was the holler pouch, or laryngeal sac, which gorillas can inflate to give resonance to their voice when they stand up and holler and thump on their chest. Anatomically, this air pouch extends to the sides of the neck and down over the anterior chest. The origin of the pouch is well above the tip of the endotracheal tube, so we were at a loss to explain why it became inflated. Now, after 5 years of consultation with various scientific colleagues, we've decided that the pouch was inflated by nitrous oxide, which diffused out of the blood into this air sac, increasing its volume. So at 8:45 p.m. now, 5 hours and 15 minutes after the beginning of the anesthesia, the abdomen was shaved and the laparotomy was begun. A thorough exploration was performed, although no definite physical cause of an intestinal obstruction could be found. 1 million units of penicillin was instilled into the peritoneal cavity. The methoxyfluorine was discontinued and the closure was begun. Now, I've heard it said by many anesthesiologists that we have difficulty in gaining the respect of our surgeon, and that many times surgeons continue to operate in spite of our request to back off a minute or two while we solve some minor problem or other. Now, as the skin was being closed in Jenny, she moved her right arm ever so slightly. She was immediately seized, naturally, by several of these zoo attendants, but the surgeon, Dr. Wayne Gossard of Oak Cliff, who for this day was most respectful of the efforts of the anesthesiologist, backed off about 20 feet and and refused to return until he'd been reassured by several people that it was safe to come back. The thing, of course, that made it safe was the introduction of succinylcholine, which we gave at first in very small doses for fear that gorillas, like four-legged animals, may respond and may be very sensitive to succinylcholine. The initial dose of 20 milligrams was followed by an additional 160 to finally produce a quiescent state in which the skin, the remainder of the skin, could be closed. During the transfer back from the operating table to the cage. Respirations were supported with an ambu bag. And when the patient was laid on his side in the cage door was closed, at which time the endotracheal tube was suctioned, the gorilla rolled up on her side, and she was extubated. She promptly rolled over, sat up, looked groggily around the room. Her first willful act was to strip away the remaining small bits of tape that had held the IV in place. This now is 10:30 in the evening, 7.5 hours after the beginning of anesthesia. The next day, she began feeding on liquids. She improved slowly and steadily, gaining weight, and completely recovered. Now the problem rose among zoo officials as to the diagnosis. It was apparent that she had no mechanical cause for her intestinal obstruction. The zoo director and the chief veterinarian were both in agreement that her problem was probably psychological and was related to the addition of a second female gorilla in the zoo family. They were convinced that Jenny's life had been saved by the 9 liters of intravenous fluids that she had received during the course of her anesthesia and surgery, that these had restored her fluid and electrolyte balance to the point where she was no longer nauseated and now had an adequate urine output. They were elated because gorillas apparently lose the will to live and die very shortly after becoming ill, even with minor illnesses. This diagnostic dilemma was solved 7 months later in December when it was discovered that Jenny had delivered a 4-pound baby gorilla, which made the diagnosis then of her June illness morning sickness or hyperemesis gravidarum. Since this time, Jenny has delivered 3 additional babies. She is now 19 years old and is in the peak of health. From a scientific point of view, then, we've made the following conclusions. First is, don't get in the cage with a gorilla. Second, it is unlikely that gorilla anesthesia will replace human anesthesia in spite of some similarities. Third, intravenous fluids are beneficial to sick gorillas as well as sick humans. Fourth, a milligram of atropine was insufficient to relax the pyloric sphincter in this particular gorilla. Fifth, Jenny had a normal human-like response to succinylcholine and thiopental. And lastly, 7.5 hours of methoxyfluorine anesthesia administered in the first trimester of pregnancy did not lead to teratogenic effects in this particular newborn.
And on that light note, we bring this issue to a close, with thanks to the speakers and to the Southern Society of Anesthesiologists for assistance in the production of this program.